understand my ups and downs. There you were, with sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotion. I want to stop. Thank you, baby. I want to stop. And thank you, baby. Yes, I do. Thank you, baby. Thank you, baby.
Well, you guessed it, boys and girls. This is Freya's Day. Freya's Day. She-Wolf Day in the bunker. And that was James Taylor, a request from one of our associates, one of our lone wolves out there. And that's a nice song. I wanted to make sure he was white, and he is white. I had to go to YouTube to make... I always check these things. You're not going to slip one in on me, baby. So on Fridays, Freya's Day, if you got a song for the She-Wolves, well, you can request it, and we'll do our best to play it. Okay. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that right there where we do all that karaoke singing. I got a brand new karaoke disc coming with about 40 songs on it. Really good stuff, and boy, I'm going to take that and put it in my little pouch, get on down to the constabulary and do some singing, probably tonight. Yeah. Okay, it is January 16th, 2015. Yeah, I have to make sure of that stuff because I get all screwed up. Okay, and our P.O. Box is Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations. That's where you send your snail mail, and then go on up to resist.com. Resist.com, and you can get much better than a Harvard education off that website. And we've reopened all the radio archives, so, you know, once in a while we get a wild hair and decide to try to close things up, then we open them up and blah, blah, blah. So, but anyhow, it all seemed to make much difference. So they're open again. Boy, our A. Wyatt Man cartoons by the A. Wyatt Man are really going big time. They're going all over the place, man. I got one guy from Russia. He said, you know, we'd have put these up during this, when the Soviet Union was around. We'd have been in the gulag, man. But now we're putting them all over the place. And some new cartoonists out there, too, are talking about putting out some more. You need cartooning is a great political, racial weapon. I mean, you can, with one cartoon, you can take the place of 10 pages of close typed script. Because that pictures get to the mind much faster than print. You got to understand that. If we could ever get back our ability that we probably lost to communicate direct from brain to brain pictures, we would be on the way again. I think we lost that way back there someplace. I think we once had it, but when you look at something, a picture, an object, and then you convert that to a word and transmit it by the word to somebody else, and then they got to get it and download it and transfer it back to a picture, and a lot of times the picture gets all screwed up. That's one of the reasons why the whole world's fucked up. People don't understand what people are talking about, and they misconstrue half the time, you know? Yeah. Okay, all you lone wolves out here, when you send me a news bulletin or anything like that that you think we might want to put out there for the whole world to see, remember, if you've got anything personal like your own email address on there, your business or anything like that, make sure you edit it out, because things are happening so fast around here to do a daily show, go through all the news and all that stuff. I don't have time all the time, and sometimes something gets out there that you might not want to get out there. So make sure you just highlight and send the main information you want me to have and eliminate the rest. Like I said before, I think better than a live interview show, which a lot of time could be wasted on nonsensical questions and answers, if you will send me MP3 files of what you've got to say and your answers to some of the things I put out here and like that, we can make it probably better than a call-in show, because we've tried call-in shows. They never worked for me, but some of the guys still use them, and they get all these ragtag, what do you call them, trolls, right-wing trolls come on there. Well, they want to argue about the baby Jesus and about abortion and apple pie and all that stuff, and believe me, forget it. Like abortions and stuff, the Republicans, there's some of the Republicans still talking about. People are going to get abortions. If they want abortions, they're going to get abortions. And the people that are always screaming about, oh, it's horrible about abortions, these are not the people that are going to say, well, I'll feed the kid. You save the kid. I'll take the kid in and feed him. You don't hear them say that. They just don't want abortion. And most of that's based on mythology of the little spirit and soul going to heaven and being with the baby Jesus up there on a cloud someplace, which is all bullshit. So there's a lot of things the right wing has, this terrible baggage that I don't think, I'm not proposing genocide or whatever against little babies, but if the white people don't want them and the mother don't want to support them or can't support them, well, what the hell can she do? None of these fat-ass conservative Republicans will take the kid in. So, you know, some will, but not many, and feed them and clothe them and raise them and all that. So most of what you hear in the right-wing conservative Republican area and the left-wing, too, only a different way, is nothing but 100% bullshit. As George Carlin says, and that's true. I've learned that over the years. About 90% of what I've learned over the years was bullshit. You got to get rid of it. You know, toss it overboard. It's not useful. It's just, you know, false flag bullshit that doesn't go anywhere. And speaking of bullshit, this thing in France is the biggest bunch of bullshit I've seen in a long time, and I've seen a lot of bullshit, man. This, like I said, if somebody went into the offices of Mad Comic Book, which incidentally, I like to read it once in a while. I don't read it very often, but it's funnier than hell because it lampoons everybody. But if somebody did go in their office and blow a bunch of people away, do you think Obama and the whole country and the conservatives and the right wing would be marching in the street arm in arm about it? No. Well, there's something else going on here. It's another false flag. They're going to use it. Now they're using it in Europe. Real quick, it jumped from the poor cartoonist being shot to we got to stop hate speech. And so now they're going to expand their hate speech laws, and they're working on it here. And they're going to use that as an excuse. And so if you don't understand that, you better start understanding. So they're after you. They don't worry too much about these ISIS guys that blew away a few people. You're dealing with people with a totally hard heart. They don't give a goddamn if a lot of people die, as long as they can make some use of those deaths, you know, and parade around on the streets and beat their chest and, we're going to get them, and we're going to get them, and all that bullshit. It's nonsense. Oh, they say they care about all these niggers down in Africa, black people, African Africans, and they kill thousands at a time down there, and they've been doing it for a long, long time, you know. And all these white Americans over here, these Christian Zionists and humanists and everybody, But they don't scream as loud about that as they do about these guys in France. I wondered about that. You know, when the blacks say you don't give a shit about the blacks in Africa, well, they're right. The only thing they care about the blacks in Africa is what they can rob their mineral rights and their oil rights and everything else right out from under them like they always have. Yeah, all that colonization of Africa, you know, as a white separatist, I would have not have been involved in that kind of stuff because there's so much difference between a white separatist and a white, just a plain white racist that's being used by predatory capitalism and mercantilism, because that kind of racism was a spinoff of the mercantilism way back when the British companies were using it all over the world. But we're not like those kind. We are race separatists. We don't want to subjugate anybody. I don't want to rule over non-whites. What a wasted time and what a hell of a job that would be. I don't want any black servants in my house. I don't want all that. We are totally different. We are true racists, racial separatists. And other races really wouldn't have too much to worry about with us if they just leave us alone and quit moving into our territory. And you know why it's our territory? Because we took the territory. And we did shove people out. And we didn't let a lot of people in. But for profit, we brought millions of niggers, African Africans, they're not African American, they're African Africans, into the country. We didn't do that. We never do it because we don't have control. We're not the ruling class. You know, that might surprise you. I mean, wake up, smell the coffee. We don't run anything. The working class in this country never has run anything. Or it's something they run that's pretty much inconsequential. But before we had all this communication and freeways and airplanes and all that, we could have an isolated white community and run things pretty much in a tribal manner with no problem. I prefer to go back to that. In fact, that's one reason I'm back here. But I still have a lot of bullshit around here and the churches to deal with, but they haven't been burning down my house or anything like that, so it's okay. But I'm here. I talked about the militias going up in the woods. Well, actually, I am close to the woods. There's woods all around me. So, come the crap hits the fan, I wouldn't go to the woods. They'd find me in 5 seconds in the woods. And you shouldn't go to the woods. That's That's a false flag idea too. That is when it's the last ditch thing that you can do. You got no other chance. They're coming, man. They're killing us in the cities. They're killing us in the urban areas. They're killing us on the railroad. They're killing us on the highway. And you got nowhere else to go. Then you go to the woods. But not like these crazy militias, these right-wing militias that say they're not racist. They're going to, because the government's going to take my gun. Well, you know what? I'm going to say something that's going to piss a lot of people off. I think a large percentage of white people in this country, I wouldn't want them to have a gun because they're fanatics on religion and everything else and crazy. If you talk nasty about the baby Jesus, they'd pull out a gun and shoot your ass. Yeah, they're fighting over this. Everybody can be armed. You know, well, I'm telling you, man, I walked into a Walmart the other day. I think I said something about there was a regular guy that didn't look like he had too much of an education. There was a hog legs on his side. And I didn't feel comfortable because I know how many whack jobs live around here and all through the Midwest. And, you know, there's something to be said about this thing. Maybe the left wing's more right than wrong. I don't want the government taking our guns away, but I think maybe we should have some control in the community of what nutcases are carrying guns. What do you think? A local controlled gun control. Oh, boy, I'm going to get the shit at me over that, man. The right wing, oh, man, you against the right to keep and bear arms. I don't believe there is a right to keep and bear arms. There is no right to anything. It's a privilege. And if you don't know the difference between a right and a privilege, you better study it. Because a right is something that allegedly cannot be taken away from you. And there's nothing that you have or you own that can't be taken away from you. So you have no right. You have privileges until the people who are the ruling class, the property class, decide to take it away. And so far, they haven't taken away this privilege to keep and bear arms. So that's the way that is, okay? And I see the marchings all going on over there in Europe, and there's a big right-wing marches now. You watch it. you watch it. They're going to do this exactly the way they did before and have done. They keep building up nationalism, and pretty soon the system will give them a leader who will say all that sounds like good stuff, you know, like maybe like Le Pen or people like that. But in the end, they'll screw them. And what is this stuff that you have to be... to be an atheist or a non-believer or something like that, that you've got to be a right-winger. Racists all have to be right-wingers. You notice that on the radio and TV? All people upset about the race issue and immigration are right-wingers. Well, I'm not a right-winger. I've dropped a whole bunch of my right-wing views. I'm pretty much out of the right wing. Once in a while, they come up with a good idea, but why is that? They always have to be a right winger. Like David Duke still has to be a KKK member. Tom Metzger, former KKK member. You know, you're out of it for 30 years, over 30 years, and you're still a KKK member. And cops are the same way. A guy can be 40 years out of retired from a police department, and if he gets in trouble... ex-police officer. Huh, what's that all about? Well, I've been getting some good response from some of the European fellows, and I had a discourse there, and I think I sent it out to you, one of our friends in England, that they've got these right-wing groups, and they think that by going out and demonstrating, they're going to change something. Well, if demonstrating would change anything, they'd make it illegal. And they almost do anyhow, because if you get out there and if you don't do it just exactly the way the system wants, they arrest you. But they want you out in the street a little bit, not too much. Not tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands with pitchforks and guns. But they do want you out there so they can get your picture get your name, get your license plate number, file you away so the Stasi British police or the Stasi American FBI and so forth know where you're at, know where to get. Why do you think they're rolling up these ISIS people so fast in France and Belgium? Well, hell, they know who these people are. They've got this tremendous NAS, intelligence, and European intelligence operation. They know where all these guys are. Why? Because they go to groups, or they go to the church, or they go someplace, and they meet together, and they don't operate as lone wolves. And so they're saying, boy, they're wrapping that up pretty quick over there in Belgium. Well, shit, why? They know who these people are. They're infiltrated up the ass. Because anybody that goes in and says, Hail Mohammed, oh, you're one of us. Join right in, just like the Christians do. Like Christian identity does. You know, you believe in the baby Jesus, and you hate the Jews? You're in, buddy. Take a gun. Go kill somebody. Well, it's time to quit the BSing and get into something else. You know, we started reading a book about a week ago, The Bible, the Devil's Book. And the first introductory, it was where somebody came down here from Mars and looked around and read this Bible and all that fire and brimstone and what a wild-ass God the Christians have. And he went back home. He took his flying saucer, went back home, said, don't mess with that earth. They're all crazy, man. So now we'll go to the first chapter. The members of the Bible Club. In the course of its history, humankind has been ravaged by all kinds of disasters, be it on a large scale or only affecting the lives of individual people. We've gotten used to it so much that we have started to find it normal, as if misfortune inevitably belongs to this world. But is that really so? Are we and our planet really predestined for calamities and misery? We think not. We think that not all the sufferings of humankind, but still a large part of them, have a very specific origin which can be clearly tracked. And we think that this specific origin is the doctrine of the Bible. That is the thesis this book wants to prove. Actually, it seems to us that the Bible brings into human spirit and in society as well ideas which are supposed to be beneficial, but which are, on the contrary, calamitous. The doctrine of the Bible programs a person with a computer virus that has intentionally been devised in order to bring to ruin that person, society, and the whole world. To put it another way, one can compare humankind with an ill person who resorts to pills and injections of a doctor called Yahweh. The more pills he takes, the more injections he gets. He hopes the faster he will recover from his illness. But actually, he does not recover at all. On the contrary, his health deteriorates more and more, for the true cause of his illness are those very pills and injections of Dr. Yahweh. I think that's true in regular practice, too. I think you get sicker most of the time when you take these pills. Those pills and injections are not medicines. They contain the very poison that makes him ill. And Yahweh is not a doctor at all. He is, in fact, an evil-minded brute who enjoys tormenting and torturing his patients. In the following chapters, we will review and analyze the nature of this poison. But before that, we need to say something more on the propagation of the Bible doctrine, which has been spread throughout the world by many different religions, ideologies, and philosophies. We call these commissionaries the members of the Bible Club. We will now introduce them to the reader. The Bible doctrine is stored in Judaism, the mother of all Bible doctrines, in Christianity and Islam. It is true that the two latter religions have produced their own holy books, the New Testament and the Quran, but it also is true that both of these holy books are partially founded on the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible. Therefore, it is proper to speak about Christian and Islamic version of the Bible doctrine But for all that, the Bible doctrine is nevertheless remains. The conversion of the European pagans to Christianity, which means the subjection of this continent to the Bible doctrine, started in the first century A.D. in Greece and Rome, and was formally brought to an end in 1386 when Europe's last pagan fortress, Lithuania, became officially Christian. In that year, the Lithuanian ruler, Grand Duke Jagiello, let himself and his nation be baptized in order to acquire the crown of the Kingdom of Poland. These days, it is common knowledge in Christian circles that evangelization of the pagan nations was at first a mere formal undertaking. The process of interiorization of the Christian Bible doctrine was difficult and took many centuries. A publication of a Rome-based Catholic Historical Research Institute distinguishes three phases of this process. Quote, at first, the adaptation of public life is stressed, as the Church was mostly able to mobilize the support of secular authorities. The introduction of a new social behavior was facilitated. An example is the ban on pagan celebrations. The following phase of evangelization, aimed at regulating the external but now individual behavior, e.g., the observation of the Sunday rest, the third phase, finally, which is without doubt the most difficult to realize, concerned the regulation of the inner behavior, the thoughts and feelings had to be gotten under control, unquote. Christianity's first mission, the adaptation of public life, was never brought to an end properly. It is a fact that a great many pagan celebrations and customs have survived until this day in Europe, sometimes in a Christian adaptation. Christmas is a well-known example. From this, one can imagine how much more hardship it took for Christianity to bring to an end the third phase. In fact, Christianity has never succeeded in carrying this job through. In Europe, a shimmer of the old spirit has always lived on until today. The very existence of this book proves that. From the moment, 18th century, that process of de-Christianization in the Occident started, logically the same phenomenon occurred at the beginning of evangelization. This means that people de-Christianized only formally in a first phase. People stopped believing in what they called God, they stopped attending Mass, and they no longer let their children be baptized. But under these externalities, deep in the Christianized mind, the Bible doctrine kept on going, just as in the first phase of evangelization. The spirit of heathendom continued living in the souls of people who called themselves formally Christians. For this reason, one expects to find that in the philosophy and ideologies that saw the light of the 18th and 19th century, e.g., Freemasonry, Darwinism, liberalism, socialism, and which further developed in the 20th century, the spirit of the Christian Bible doctrine lives on. This is actually the case. All these new world views do carry with them the genetic material of the Bible doctrine. This will be shown in this book. Therefore, we permit ourselves to incorporate a lot of new members into the club of carriers of the Bible doctrine, besides Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We would like to group together these members under the name of Occidental Post-Christianity, which could also be called Christianity without God. Communism. While the death struggle of Christianity proper began in the 19th century, its spiritual post-Christian children were already there to take over. In the 19th century, however, another version of Bible doctrine was conquering the field, Judaism. After the French Revolution, Judaism had been socially emancipated everywhere in Western Europe. To put it differently, the Jews got their entry ticket to our society. They soon managed to leave their mark. This did not only happen in the fields of finance, politics, and economy, but also as a part of culture and philosophy were concerned. In other words, during the 19th century, Europe got another injection of the Bible doctrine, but this time it came not out of the usual Christian corner, but from Judaism. It's interesting that Christianity came out of Judaism, and then Judaism comes back to inject itself into so-called Christian society. In the course of the 19th century and later in the 20th, many influential Jewish thinkers, politicians, and others started to appear on the scene. This was something new in our history. There are plenty of examples. Take, for instance, the personalities such as Benjamin Disraeli, 1804-1881, the famous British statesman and writer. Ferdinand LaSalle, 1825-1864, one of the leaders of the German workers' movement. And Sigmund Freud, 1856-1939, the founder of Jewish psychoanalysis. By far the best known of these Jewish personalities is unquestionably Karl Marx, 1818-1883. This man is universally regarded as the spiritual father of communism, or at least to show some consideration for people who would rightly remark that communism was actually older than Marx as the most significant thinker of that ideology. It is common knowledge that Marx, who was born in the city of Trier in Germany, I've been in Trier. I used to have a lot of fun in Trier. He was of Jewish origin. His father, Herschel H. Levy, later had his name changed to Heinrich Marx. Herschel descended from a famous family of rabbis, which seems to have produced some eminent Talmud teachers, like, for instance, Eliezer H. Levy. The mother of Karl Marx, Henrietta Pressburg, also was a rabbi's daughter, and also seems to have descended from a prominent family of teachers and wise men. Some biographers of Marx do not hide the fact that it is possible to discover a certain Jewish influence in his works. At the end of this book, the reader will be able to judge for himself how much of this is true. The fact that Marx, during his lifetime, reacted against Judaism, and sometimes without pulling punches, like in his paper, quote, Zur Judenfrage, does not change this. He wrote A World Without Jews. And he also was racist, because his son-in-law was a mulatto. And one time he said, his son-in-law belongs in the zoo. As we will try to show, communism should be seen as what could be called a duplicate of Judaism, one without God, to be sure. This is not only due to the origin of its most prominent thinker. There is another element involved. It is a fact that the Soviet Union, the state which was to become the model par excellence of what East Germans would call real existierend communism, was founded by people who were mostly Jewish stock. Consider Lenin himself, whose maternal grandfather was Jewish, Lev Trotsky, alias Lev Bronstein, Grigoria Sinoviev, alias Gerson Radomysky, and Affelbaum, according to some sources, Lev Kamenev, alias Rosenfeld, Yakov Sverlov, and there's several other names there that I can't pronounce, or I could, but I ain't going to try. To put it briefly, we are talking about what is almost complete leadership of the Soviet Union in its early stages, the very top of the party and the administration. The Jewish presence was not limited to the top. Jewish people held positions throughout the entire Soviet apparatus. Experts say that Jews were especially dominant in the diplomatic corps, the press, and the secret police. Hey, that's what we've got here. These people begot the Soviet baby and shaped its personality in its early childhood. The years are regarded as being the most important from the educational point of view. In this way, it is not only the communist theory that bears, thanks to Marx, and stamp of Judaism. Thanks to those Jewish Soviet leaders and executives, the practice of communism as well had an unmistakable Jewish bias. European history, an explanation of this lack of information is not difficult to imagine. Therefore, the next chapter will be devoted to this little-known subject. Well, I submit that the Soviet Union was state capitalism. predatory capitalists hiding behind what they call communism. Of course, you know the desire of every capitalist is to control all the capital there is for himself. So I've always said, and for decades the right wing screams at me, I say, look, it was capitalism because everybody in the Soviet Union was property of the state. And everything in the Soviet Union was property of the state. The centralization of the economy, which is state capitalism, not communism. There was no real redistribution of the wealth, except in minor cases. The guys at the top controlled the money. The Communist Party controlled almost everything. Anyhow, next chapter, the unexpected sixth member. During the so-called ancient regime, the era before the French Revolution, the European Jews did not enjoy full civil rights. Well, nobody does, because there are no rights or only privileges. On the other, that's why they take them away all the time and give them back. And then people say, I want my human rights, I want my rights, I want my racial rights, I want this right and that right. Well, forget it, you'll never get a right, you're going to get a privilege if you get anything. On the other hand, in some places they enjoyed privileges like rabbinical jurisdiction over members of the Jewish community. In other words, the system wanted to keep them out, the wacky religion out of their hair as much as possible. By the end of the 18th century, a movement saw the light in progressive circles in Europe to put Jews in the position of full civil privileges. I'm not going to say rights when I read this. The year 1791 saw a great breakthrough. In that year, the French Constitutional Assembly decided to bestow full civil rights, civil privileges on the Jews. I think that happened during Napoleon's reign. You know, at one time, Napoleon wanted to go to Jerusalem and wanted him to be knighted the king of the Jews. Yeah. I never knew that before, a book I read the other day. They didn't let him do it. probably because they knew his time was getting short. But before this decision was made, great trepidation had to be overcome and a lot of pressure and lobbying had to be carried out. As a consequence, French Jews were able to build up in a short time a strong position in French society. I'm trying to remember what I heard on the radio the other day, that the Jews in France were the biggest concentration of Jews in Europe, were in France, and have been for a long time. The 19th century French, that's why Hitler didn't get too much resistance when he went into France and started hauling the Jews off. Okay, 19th century French priest Abbé Layman, himself from the Jewish stock, put it this way, quote, "The French nation has been so magnanimous to open for them, the Jews, the avenues of society without caring about the consequences. By the time it became noticed that the Jews were citizens, they were already in charge, at least partially." Well, what do we got now? We got massive numbers of Jews in France, and now you got massive numbers of other Semites in France. So France is gone. France has been gone for quite a while. I mean, you know, the only way they'll ever get it back is to have wholesale expulsion and whatever needs to be done. Bring me the boxcars, baby. In the course of the 19th century, the rest of Europe underwent the same process. The Jews were given full... Okay, come on. I need a page-turning device. Privileges, that's right. After which they grew into a mighty power group in society. There was one great exception, old Tsarist Russia. There, the Jews continued to be subjected to all kinds of restrictions. You can't rob the people. You can't murder them. You can't steal. You can't screw up the government. Because of this, Russia was saddled with deep hatred from the international Jewish community. Social emancipation of the Russian Jewry finally took place with the Communist Revolution. Surprise, surprise. All those Bolshevik Jews financed in New York coming over there. When the Jewish revolutionaries assumed power and started nearly at once to suppress every sign of anti-Semitism. Just remember that these Jewish revolutionaries are always handled from the background by the capitalists. They're financed by the capitalists, and they're used to destroy something, like they did in Russia, wherever they go. But the arch fiend in the back is predatory capitalism. The European country where the Jews prospered the most was Germany. The so-called emancipation process started there in 1812, when the Prussian government issued an edict to grant Jews full civil privileges. The famous Berliners salons played an important role in this emancipation process. The last restrictions were abolished in 1871, the year of German unification and the proclamation of the Second Empire. Jewish historian Fritz Stern is an expert with regard to the history of German Jewry. This is what he writes on their achievements in the 19th century German society. Quote, "It had probably never been the case before anywhere in Europe that a minority was so successful in gaining social status and achieving so much as the German Jewry was in the 19th century, unquote. Besides the old nobility, a new upper crust came into being in the 19th century Germany, industrialists, bankers, intellectuals, politicians, and so on. In this new civil elite, Jews were represented out of proportion to their share of the population. Stern writes, quote, around the middle of the century, Jews were 2-3% of the population of Berlin. Approximately 50% of the early entrepreneurs in the city were Jewish stock. In 1881, Jews constituted 4.8% of the Berlin population, 0.4% of the civil servants, 8.6% of the writers and journalists, 25.8% of the people operating on the money market, and 46% of the wholesaler, retailers, and forwarding agents. In many Silesian towns, Jews, while making up about 4% of the population, accounted for more than 20% of the tax proceeds. And in the 80s, a member of the British Embassy in Berlin found that after the decline of the old landed interest and the rise of industry, the country's capital was soon transferred into the hands of a limited number of extremely rich Jews. You know, of these right-wing racist groups that talk about Jews would require that every new person that becomes a member of their group read two or three of these books and take a test on them. They might get someplace, but they don't. They just scratch the surface. They just give them the surface of it. Hate the Jews. Oh, why? Oh, just hate them. Well, why should I hate them? Oh, just shut up and go out and demonstrate, march up and down. Get a uniform, will you? Put a swastika on. That'll really get you someplace. By far the most successful Jew at that time was Gerson von Bleichroder, 1822-1893. This banker became the first Prussian Jew ever to be raised to nobility. He was one of the mightiest persons in Germany. He sometimes was nicknamed the German Rothschild. Bleichroder administered Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, the man who succeeded in uniting the many independent German principalities into the Second Reich, personal fortune. I think that was a mistake by unifying all those parts. The more you unify, the worse it gets. That's my opinion. It happened here in the United States, too. Of course, that was all about, turning it into a federal system, and then they had it easy. He managed to scrape together the money for Bismarck's war efforts, which the Prussian Parliament refused to give him, and acted as Bismarck's personal advisor and secret diplomat. which happens in almost every government, if not all. Another example of a prominent and influential Jewish personality was Albert Behlen, 1857 to 1917, the big boss of Hapag, which was at the time the world's largest shipping company. He was the secret counselor of the Emperor Wilhelm II. Walter Rathenau, 1867 to 1922, another Jew, was the son of the founder of AEG, whom he succeeded as managing director. He expanded AEG into the huge international company, Rathenau. Rathenau was a personal friend of Wilhelm II and ranked as the coming man in the imperial court. During the Great War, he was in charge of the Department of Raw Materials in the Prussian Ministry of War. That's where the money is, baby. War. After the war, he became Minister of Recovery and Foreign Affairs. In the labor movement and in the political left, Jewish people like Johann Jacobi, Paul Singer, Ferdinand LaSalle, and Hugo Haas played key roles. This was especially true as far as German communism was concerned. One could say that with personalities like Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, and Kurt Eisner, German communism was almost a kosher affair. These and other Jewish communists would lead the unsuccessful attempts at the end of the First World War and therefore to raise a communist revolution in Germany. So when Hitler said, you know, they were putting all these communists in concentration camps over there, a hell of a big percentage were Jew. So was it because they were Jewish? I think in many cases it was because they were communists. And, of course, they were the arch enemy of what Uncle Adolf had in mind. Jews were overrepresented in the intellectual professions. In 1933, when Hitler took power and the glorious days of German Jewry were over, 5,557 out of 51,067 German doctors and 3,030 out of 18,641 German lawyers and notaries made themselves known as Jewish. One has to keep in mind that these figures do not contain those persons who were from Jewish origin but did not want to make that public. It is not surprise at all that Jews dominated the cultural microcosm and the press. See, that's what you got to do. They got to get a hold of the press. And that's what they've done in this country. Because you don't have an opinion. It's just the press's opinion. They say what your opinion's going to be. They don't have the time or the initiative to do that. And so when they say freedom of speech and freedom of the press, they mean big corporate press. All the big press is controlled by a few corporations. All the big radio networks and TV networks controlled in the background by Jews and or Christians who are just as much Jewish acting as the Jews, sometimes even worse. Nahum Goldman, the later Zionist leader, wrote, quote, their position in intellectual life was unique too. In literature, they were represented by illustrious names. Theater was in their hands for the greater part. The daily press, and especially the influential international papers, were basically in the hands of or controlled by Jews. Now you wonder why Tom Metzger don't get on TV or in the news? Well, they'll put a right-winger on there. They'll put a dumbass guy that can't tie his shoes on who happens to be in the Klan or something. But they learned in the 80s not to put Tom Metzger on. Now, I'm not saying I'm great and all that kind of, I'm just telling you I had some effect. I and my son had quite a bit of effect by going on national TV. And finally they said, we've got to stop this shit. These guys were putting them on there trying to make them look like clowns, and they come up with legitimate arguments or arguments that we don't like, but it's getting to the people, so we got to stop that. The Jewish entry into German society resulted in a large number of Jews becoming part of that society. It was only a small minority that continued to consider itself a separate nation, which had nothing to do with the German nation. In this way, these people were the precursors of the Zionist movement. The majority of German Jews, however, saw themselves as Germans from the Jewish faith just like there were Germans from the Catholic and Lutheran faith. Now remember, all of it is Jewish. Others even went further on the path of integration and had themselves baptized. And that's probably a sad part of the thing, because there were lots of integrated Jews that had thrown off Jewry. They did not play with the Jew situation at all. But yet when they picked up the Jews, they picked up everybody. I think they went overboard. In fact, I know they went overboard. Even propaganda-wise, it was overboard. An important factor in the Germanization was the numerous mixed marriages. At one time, 30% of Jews married non-Jews. In 1933, the year Hitler took power, no less than 40% of the Jews in Berlin were married out of their group. The integration was done, and I think, I have said for quite some time, I think that was at the heart of a lot of this problem of picking up Jews. I think the Zionists wanted to punish these Jews that were marrying out of their group. I think that was a lot of it. And they felt by a persecution plan of the Jews in Germany, the kind that were assimilating, they would force them back into hardcore Judaism. That's my opinion. I don't know. The integration was profound. There existed, for instance, Jewish student clubs with members who were dressed up as martially as their Teutonic counterparts, complete with sword, riding boots, cap, uniform. Jewish parents called their children Siegfried and Hilda, had them learn by heart the works of Goethe, or play the sonatas of Beethoven. Prominent Jews yearned for an imperial order, a title of nobility, or an officer's career for their sons. And remember, a large percentage of Jews were in the First World War, and they were out there getting gassed just like everybody else. The German Jews felt like Germans. How much this was true can be seen from the large number of Jewish volunteers fighting with the Prussians against Napoleon in 1813. Out of 10,000 volunteers, 700 seemed to have been Jews. That means that proportionally more Jews volunteered to take up arms than Germans did. In the First World War, 10,000 Jews volunteered in the Imperial Army, which numbered about 100,000 Jews on the whole. Some 35,000 of them were decorated. But the integration of the German Jewry went even further than that, and now they are running into a strange phenomenon, strange for people living in an era after the Second World War. And, of course, remember, these Ashkenazi Jews come from the East. These seedy, greasy, kinky hair type came from the East, and these Sephardic Jews in Germany hated their guts and wanted them out of there. And that was one of the reasons they went along with Hitler early on. After the abolition of the last restrictions and the coming into being of the Second Reich, in 1871, German Jews, or Germans from Jewish stock, became even more Germanophile than the Germans themselves. The Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann, 1874 to 1952, once drew the following description of the rich, patriotic Jews of that time, who often were called Kaiser Juden, even more Germanophile than Germans themselves, submissive, super patriotic, eagerly anticipating the plans and wishes of Germany's rulers. Remember some of these Hollywood producers back in the day making all those real patriotic movies, and they were trying to, well, you can read it in a book, An Empire of Their Own, where they were trying to fit in and be patriotic and all that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of it was honest. I do. And I'll get a note about that, too. Fuck them. I'm going to do it my way. The Jews passed for a cornerstone of a new empire in which they were so successful. Therefore, it can be regarded as highly symbolic that it was a Jew, Eduard von Simson, who on the 18th of December, 1870, was president of the first Reichstag, offering the first imperial crown to King Wilhelm I. Fritz Stern remarks, quote, "Nearly all of the Jews took advantage of the foundation of the new empire. In the new empire, all Jews became eager patriots. One can even say super patriots, unquote. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. A French observer noticed in 1916, quote, even today people in Germany still see themselves as inhabitants of Prussia, Saxony, Baden, Wurttemberg, and Bavaria. Only the Jews are exclusively German. From north to south, from east to west, they are the pillars of the Reich, unquote. After the unification, Heinrich Oppenheimer, a Jewish member of the Reichstag, declared, for the German Jews, the Messiah has come along with the German fatherland. Wow. Some people called the Second Reich, jokingly, the German Reich of the Jewish nation, in reference to the name of the First Reich. Quote, the Holy Roman Reich of the German nation. Others baptized it New Palestine. Abroad, too, the prevailing view was that the character of the new state was at least as Jewish as it was German. In a French play, which seems to have been staged frequently around the turn of the century, it was said, quote, Prussia and Israel have started a relationship, and the acid to destroy it has not been invented thus far. The personal advisor of the first German ambassador to the State of Israel, Jörg von Uthman, has written an interesting and well-documented book on the relations between Germans and Jews. He stated, quote, with no other nation had the Jews started such close a symbiosis as with the German nation, unquote. I think you begin to maybe see what I've been telling you, that there was something going on there that the top Zionists, the big boys, were upset. These Jews were all leaving Judaism and either becoming Christians or not, and becoming regular citizens of Germany. And that's got to stop. They're going to assimilate right off. We're not going to be around anymore. One must say that in the 19th and in the beginning of the 20th century, German Jewry identified itself warmly and pronouncedly with the country wherein they were so successful and influential, be it the field of economics and cultural life, or as far as politics were concerned. German Jews, like influential Emmensis Grist, Gerson von Blickroder, could be overcome by boundless patriotism and burning love for the German fatherland. On the 4th of July, 1866, the day after the victory of the Prussians against the Austrians, the eminent banker wrote to Bismarck, quote, I dare to disturb you with these lines on the very moment that intense prayers of thanksgiving rise to the Almighty for the grace that he has shown our fatherland with the victory of his Majesty's brilliant army against our hereditary enemy. Filled with awe for your highness, I dare to express it by sincerely congratulating your highness for his successful policy, and I mostly obediently beg you to be kind enough to lay down my humble congratulations at his Majesty's feet. I will express my gratitude by dedicating myself to the cause of our wounded soldiers, unquote. Another prominent German Jew, the already mentioned Walter Rathenau, was also a passionate patriot. He described himself as follows. I am a German of Jewish stock. My nation is the German nation. My fatherland is the German fatherland. My faith is the German faith, which transcends the various confessions, unquote. This is rather peculiar, for Rathenau was a member of the B'nai B'rith, the mighty international Jewish Freemason Lodge. So far as people like Rathenau were concerned, being a convinced German and a convinced Jew at the same time did not seem to be a problem. Neither did it seem to be a problem of being a Jew and an anti-Semite at the same time. The same B'nai B'rith brother, Walter Rathenau, to name just him, did not mince his words when talking about his own race. Quote, an Asiatic horde on Brandenburg's sandy soil, unquote. Now, here they're referring primarily to the Ashkenazim Eastern Jews, who were Asiatic, and they were definitely different than the Sephardic more Europeanized biologically than these guys, and they didn't like him. That's one thing that helped Hitler get his foot in the door on moving the Jews out, because the Jews understood that he was going to move out this Asiatic horde of kinky-haired, cross-racial, mixed Jews and get them out of Germany. They didn't think he was going to turn on them. He called the Jewish communist agitator Karl Radek, quote, a nasty fellow, the typical Jewish boy, unquote. A man like Gerson von Bleichroeder did his utmost to help his fellow Jews in Eastern Europe, but on the other hand, he did not even bother about inviting his own family to his magnificent parties. A police report from the year 1874 reveals Mr. Gerson von Bleichroeder, who is mad with pride since he was raised to nobility and who is no longer in the company of his old acquaintances and business friends, also separates himself from them when he goes for a walk. During his promenades along the Caesar's Alley, he always strolls on the west side of it, whereas most of the walkers, almost exclusively Jews, strolled on the east side. When asked why he did so, he said to have answered that, for his part, it reeked too much of garlic across the street. This statement has come to the attention of several of Mr. Bleichroeder's former acquaintances. They appear to have accosted him about this matter several days ago in the alley, and the conversation seems not to have been very cordial. Unquote. Anti-Semitism on the part of converted Jews or dissenters was, by the way, nothing new in Europe. There exists a whole list of such people. An example is the converted Jew Rindfleisch, who seems to have been in 1298 the instigator of one of the largest pogroms in the Middle Ages. The most notorious of this kind of the people was Thomas Torquemada, 1420 to 1498, the Spanish Great Inquisitor, who had about 2,000 persons executed and ran the Jews out of Spain. During his period of office, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain took place. You see? And, of course, the Catholic Church, another powerhouse, wasn't too unhappy about that. You got to understand that a whole lot of the anti-Jewish propaganda and so forth is put together by the Catholic Church or even the Lutheran Church. As competitors, they're all competitors for money and members, and that's what a lot of people don't understand. And so a lot of this anti-Jewish stuff was fomented and pushed and inflamed by a Christian church. So anyhow, one comes from this kind of zeal everywhere, where people switch over from one group to another and feel the need to prove to themselves and the outside world that they no longer belong to the former group. Such people can be very dangerous for that group from which they once were a part. In fact, some of the biggest persecutors of the Jews, I've said before, were Jews. That they went a different direction. And anyhow, you get the point. An element that played a significant role in the anti-Semitism of German Jewry was the so-called Ostjuden, Eastern Jews. Here we go. The free emancipation of German Jews did not like these immigrants from Eastern Europe, who swarmed into Germany at the end of the 19th century. They mentally still lived in the ghetto and were more attracted to Jewish nationalism and Zionism than their German co-religionists. The bad image of the Ostjuden did not much benefit from the fact that later on they appeared to be the backbone of revolutionary communism in Russia and Germany, and a revolution was something that the free and well-off German Jews needed just as little as the ghetto of the olden days. After the Great War, the leaders of German Jewry even made an appeal to the presidents Hindenburg and Ebert to impose an immigration stop on Ostjuden. Keep those damn kinky-haired guys out of here. Now, I read one book where it said they were coming into Germany and setting up card tables on the street and loaning money out and stuff. And this really upset the Western Jews. And it was not a coincidence. In fact, they said at the time, you're going to get us all killed. That's what they screamed at these Eastern Jews. And it was not a coincidence that it was a German Jew, the young Count Arco Auf Valley, a German nationalist who in February 1919 killed Eastern Jew Kurt Eisner, the leader of the revolutionary rule in Munich. So here we got a Western Jew knocking off an Eastern Jew. And don't forget, there were 40,000 Jews that served in the Wehrmacht in the Second World War. They don't talk about that much. The book came out, and then quietly, it wasn't given much publicity. The spectacular rise of the German Jews during the Second Reich and the Weimar Republic and their great influence was not unnoticed by the Germans themselves. The amount of anti-Semitism brought about by this, mostly in the 70s and 80s of the 19th century, was nevertheless rather harmless nature, as only could have been expected from disciplined and law-abiding people like the Germans. In any case, the Jews did not lose much sleep over it. The following statement gives evidence to this. These mocking words had attributed to Max Liebermann, 1874 to 1939, the Jewish painter and president of the Prussian Academy of Arts. Quote, "You know nothing will become of that anti-Semitism as long as the Jews don't take care of it themselves." There you go. Well, that's enough for today. Let's see, what is today? Friday? Oh, we'll be back tomorrow. Maybe we'll read some more. Anyhow, I hope along the way that we all pick up some information off these books, because I don't think anybody else is promoting them or reading them or talking about them or anything. I shouldn't say nobody is, but everybody's got their slant. I try to look at something without a slant. Try to be more moderate in my looking at the situation. I know you'll laugh your ass off at saying I'm moderate, but I try to look at history in a more rational way than people on either side, right or left. And so I hope you appreciate that. I don't try to bend history to fit just me or what I believe. I can give you theories of what I think may have happened, but I'm not going to ram stuff down your throat. So 14 words and 5 words. I have nothing to say, and I'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.